Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm your sugar daddy, David Santo. Am I the sugar baby in this relationship? Oh, it's also confusing when it comes to sweetness. It's a flavor profile that's all about equilibrium and things being out of balance. That's what this episode aims to explore, the sweet and the comforting, as well as the sour, bitter, and quite discomforting nature of sugar. But before things get too sticky, take a moment and listen to this. That was the sound of sweetness, of labor, and of life itself. It was, of course, the familiar buzzing of bees going about their daily habits of sipping nectar, building hives, raising their young, and distributing pollen from plant to plant. Without bees and other pollinators, agriculture would be nigh unto impossible. Their work enables plants to reproduce, which in turn feeds the multiple billions of us here on planet Earth. But over the last two decades, the environmental conditions of pollinators' workplaces have been severely degraded. Urbanization, the use of neonicotinoids and other pesticides, invasive parasites, and lots of other factors have been reported as causes of what's called colony collapse disorder, the sudden disappearance or death of entire bee colonies. Contributing to the situation is the agricultural management practice of transporting beehives from one location to another, sometimes across an entire country, just to provide what are called pollination services on farmlands. In other words, bees are being used as effectively forced agricultural laborers, often in wildly different places with unfamiliar flora and landscapes. It's apparently highly disorienting, as well as very stressful to bees, both individually and collectively. Plus, if you're concerned about the ethical treatment of animals and food systems, the practice is undeniably questionable. While colony collapse disorder may have been slowed to a certain extent by dedicated researchers and conservationists and some food producers, it's an indicator of how problematic many of our food production systems really are. We are so completely interdependent with all of the plants and animals on this planet, but we can also be pretty disdainful of the smallest of those creatures, including the ones who effectively work for us. On the sweeter side of things, the production of honey includes some really fascinating stories. One of the most international of all foods, honey is both mythical and mundane. Because it can be produced across a wide variety of landscapes, honey is in many ways a representation of diversity and of localness and sustainability. It's infused with beliefs related to immune system protection and superfood status. It soothes our sore throats when we have a cold, and it's probably the first sugar source to have been fermented into alcohol in ancient history. Honey self-preserves, too, and samples have been found that date back thousands and thousands of years. Today, highly intensive technologies are used to extract sucrose from sugarcane and sugar beets, and the industry is both highly damaging and highly profitable. High fructose corn syrup, another very intensively produced industrial ingredient, has replaced sucrose in many processed foods. And, of course, a vast range of sugar substitutes now occupy their own place in so-called diet foods. Our seemingly endless love of sweetness derives from several sources: physiological, emotional, psychological. You could also say that all those are just one source altogether, our body, given that minds and bodies are all part of our one organism. We often find comfort in things that are sweet, though we also associate them with guilt and shame and other less cheerful feelings. As you'll hear from our two guests today, comfort and discomfort and pleasure and stress all emerge from eating sugar. It's a source of many things, just as we source it from many places. The conversations in this episode avoid the usual discussions of how saccharides affect physical health. There's already plenty of online content about that, much of which needs to be taken with a grain of, well, sugar. Both of my guests think about and deploy sweetness in their work, and both have some pretty wide and engaging perspectives on the subject. After listening, it'll be up to you where your taste buds and psyche will take you, as with everything related to food. During Stick This in Your Mouth, Maxime and I taste three sweet substances while we consider their origins and wonder about how we appreciate them in our adult lives. And for the food questionnaire, I ask a political and social changemaker about her food ways, preferences, and sources of pride, even though I kind of knew some of the answers to begin with. Kicking things off is Dr. Jordan LaBelle, a teacher and researcher in food and experience marketing. Jordan started working in professional kitchens at the age of 12 and has since worked as a chef, a restaurant reviewer, an industry consultant, and a much-loved university professor. His food research takes the angle of how we derive pleasure and comfort from what we eat and how that affects our consumption behavior. And he's an expert in chocolate and maple, among other things. He's also the owner of a vintage cookbook collection with publications dating back to the year 1742. Jordan, thank you so much for being here and talking to me about all things sweet. A lot of your work, both in the past and the present, is focused on the idea of comfort food. Can you tell me more about that?
As long as I can remember, I've been fascinated by our relationship to food. I grew up on a small farm with parents who were business folks, gentleman farmer kind of thing, part-time farmers. And my grandma, with whom I spent quite a bit of time as a kid, taught me how to cook desserts, you know, and showed me a way around the kitchen. I remember she had a pantry in which for me was fascinating. It was like La Caverne d'Ali Baba, you know, it was a magical kind of place. And on the one side, there were canned foods and a bunch of stuff, preserves that she would make. And on the other side were notes and scrapbooks she would keep, which I inherited when she passed away, and the treasure trove of information in those scrapbooks and things. And that always fuels sort of my interest in understanding why do we eat the way we do, right? And I think a category of food that is just so, I don't want to say easy, but so almost automatic or natural to study, it's comfort foods. Yeah. We all have comfort foods, but they differ greatly between genders, age groups, cultural backgrounds. And so that's a little bit what prompted me to study this. And when I was doing my PhD, I first thought to explore this notion of comfort food. I would focus on this notion of pleasure, which, you know, back then in marketing was a topic that was just beginning to be discussed and to be formally addressed by academics. And I had devised a series of studies that I wanted to run using yogurt, because I was applying at the same time for a grant through the Danone Institute. And I figured, okay, yogurt is a bit of a stable fat base and I can just manipulate the flavoring, you know, lemon flavoring, nobody's going to like that. Vanilla, everybody loves. And that would give me an entry, a foothold into understanding people's relationship to pleasurable gustatory response. And I went on the road to present my preliminary ideas. And I ended up visiting a former advisor of mine at Yale. And he let me present, very polite, of course. And after I was done, he said, so let me understand this. You're going to study pleasure by feeding people yogurt. And everybody in the room started laughing. And it dawned on me, you know, the penny dropped. I said, gee, I need to pick up on something else. And so I came back to Montreal. And the idea was to get a food base that has sort of a stable sort of fat base. So you, from version to version, you don't change the calorimetric properties, but you can alter people's response. And so chocolate basically is kind of that, because you have a stable base and you can add flavorings, which don't change much the calorimetric properties or profile of the chocolate, and people will have a vastly different response between whatever chocolate you feed them. And so I ended up latching on this to study comfort food. And from there, I just fell down the rabbit hole.
Of chocolate. It's a very complex idea, the idea of comfort. It comes from a lot of places. I mean, you mentioned your grandmother's pantry, Ali Baba's cave full of delights. But where, more broadly, does comfort come from for most people? Is it a combination of different elements? Is it biological, physical, psychological? What makes up comfort for us?
The short answer is yes and. Yes and a whole lot more things. Interestingly enough, yes, you know, you can't study comfort foods, you can't study our relationship to pleasure without somehow tippy-toeing or addressing personal associations, mental connections that people have. And that's That fuels a bit of our trajectory towards certain kinds of food. And there's the notion that we're innately programmed to prefer things that are sweet and fat because it ties into our natural preservation and survival. So that's, you know, one explanation, but I think it just scratches the surface, really. Looking at the asymmetry between gender, between people of different cultural backgrounds or ages in terms of how they come to their favorite comfort food. And one thing we realize, and there's been quite a few other articles published since on different types of comfort food. Basically, the going intuition and knowledge before 2005, 2008 was that comfort foods were high in fat and sugar, open and shut case. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's some truth to that, but I thought there was more to the story. So we invited people to tell us about their favorite comfort food. To our surprise, a lot of people mentioned things that could, on the whole, be considered fairly healthy, not necessarily loaded in sugar or fat. A nice soup, a comforting cup of tea. I even had someone mention baby carrots, and that really threw me off. And when we did an interview with that person, this person mentioned that, yeah, because when I was a kid, my mom put them in my lunchbox. And now as an adult, when I eat them, it's a throwback to my childhood.
So, there's a strong, that yes. emotional connection, that sense of history, the sense of comfort, emotional and parental comfort yeah. translates into food as well.
So it's not just a gustatory type of response. So there was that. And then we kept on digging and we asked people, like, tell us about a typical episode in which you consume this. And it was really interesting because some people would say, well, first of all, I only eat my favorite comfort food when I'm alone. Like, it's a very private moment. I don't eat it if someone else can see me eat it. And then there were, I remember distinctively that this woman telling us about eating ice cream. Okay, what's so special about that? Well, then she tells us that she will only eat it from this one special bowl. And she swears the ice cream does not taste the same if she eats it out of other bowls. So it speaks to the complex sort of narrative and trajectory, or, you know, that episodic sort of unfolding when you eat a comfort food. It's not just grab anything. The relationship we have to these foods is way more complex. I remember another gentleman who was telling us about what he particularly, and this gentleman was born during the war and so had known some difficult times. And he mentioned that his favorite comfort food is this tartinade de lard, a spread with lard.
Like a toast, right? with lard, yeah. Whipped lard on it, yeah.
And in Quebec, we have graisse de rôti, you know, we have similar things. And it's funny because we were doing this focus group and this gentleman had not talked. And so we sort of politely circled back to him and said, hey, what, you know, what's your favorite comfort food? And he was embarrassed to admit it. And he said, well, I know nowadays nutritionists tell me I should not be eating that. But once in a while, I can't help myself. It's like, it's my comfort food. It's the one thing that takes me back to my childhood. And even though it's not à la mode. So I love studying these kinds of, you know, what appear to be anecdotal type of stories. But when you cover or you survey enough people, you realize that they're more popular. They're more, you know, present in our everyday relationship to food and comfort food, particularly than we would first suspect.
When you were doing that research and more generally, would you say that sweetness and sugary things are more often comfort food, or is it about 50-50, or are there other, is it just a lot less measurable than that?
It depends. Mm-hmm. I think it depends on age. It depends on one's particular circumstances. I've interviewed a lot of Asians, for example, and their comfort foods vary widely. Some can be very savory. They don't have to be sweet. Some have, you know, have the sort of sweet sour thing combination going. I would avoid such generalization because I think it can lead us to overlook other foods, other behaviors that could fall under that comfort food type of umbrella, you know. And more researchers are finding out that there's different kinds of comfort food. There's the celebratory comfort food. There's the I'm stressed out of my mind kind of comfort food, right? So I think we turn to comfort foods for different reasons, and that may lead us towards certain choices versus others.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think it is that in the sort of top level consciousness of a lot of people, sweet things, it's a go-to?
It is true that by and large, and there's research that clearly shows that whether you're under chronic stress or momentary stress, your body will crave energy, will crave sort of the sugary taste. And now there's even more research suggesting that one of the things we become sort of hooked on is not so much the sugar itself, although that does have a metabolic impact. It's really the taste of sweetness. So whether that taste is produced through honey, sugar substitute, or anything like that, it's really that sort of charge of that sweet mouthfeel that gets us sort of craving our favorite foods. When you're depleted, whether it's energetically depleted, mentally depleted, we tend to turn more towards things that are sweeter. But we have to give sweets a large definition, I think. I remember a series of women we interviewed and mentioned that a good soup can be comforting. And if you think of veggies and other components of the soup, it is a form of sugar in a way, you know? So I think we have to give sugar a bit of a broad definition and then re-examine the way we come to it. In what circumstances? And are they all sort of comfort driven or are they triggered by other kinds of emotions? For example, boredom. Boredom is one. I mean, among students and amongst younger population, eating out of boredom, and it's now well documented in nutritional publications that it is one mode of eating. You just eat mindlessly out of boredom.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I've always understood that one of the reasons that sweet does tend to provide a sense of comfort or a sense of reassurance or a pleasure is because the sweetness of mother's milk as being one of the very first tastes that we've had, it's an association with that deep sense of comfort of being fed and nurtured by one's parent.
And that's another layer of explanation, but it doesn't explain everything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't explain the nuances. It doesn't explain all the gymnastic or the theatrical accoutrement and everything we do to get to our favorite comfort food. That's what makes it fun to study. And also from a marketing perspective, that's oftentimes what gives us an entry into being able to talk to consumers in a way that goes beyond, I'm just going to open parenthesis because I really get pissed or disappointed when I see ads for food and particularly comfort foods or chocolate that are promoted or marketed with such these sort of easy mental association, you know, treat yourself to an indulgence. Why entertain these sort of messed up approach avoidance kind of associations? But if you want to go beyond that, then you have to dig below the surface. Then you have to start considering idiosyncrasies and anecdotes and, you know, the material culture, even of objects that we use to indulge, so to speak, in our favorite comfort foods. And that's where it gets interesting.
Oh, it's incredibly rich stuff. And indeed, there are so many different relationships that we have with our food, healthy or unhealthy, or however you want to categorize them, cheerful, pleasurable, relaxed, anxious, neurotic.
On a separate episode, get me going on a good donut.
I will. Thank you. Well, thank you so much. This has been an absolutely fabulous conversation. I would love to talk with you for hours and hours and hours, but we both have other things to do.
We'll save the conversation on donuts for another time.
Well, there's cake to be eaten and soup yes. to be made. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your invitation.
And to follow Jordan, his interests, and his work, check him out on X, where he goes by the handle Dr. Pleasure. Coming up next is a chat with the delightful Sonia Samut, a pastry artist and entrepreneur and the proprietor of Sachère Desserts. Her shop in the Centre Sud neighborhood of Montreal is a destination for cake and ice cream lovers of all kinds, drawn by her distinctive flavor combinations and very elegant visual aesthetics. On summer afternoons, happy customers hover on the sidewalk outside, slurping up her soft-serve ice cream in some pretty wild and wonderful flavors. And how do I know? I happen to be her neighbor. Sachère is literally three doors down from my apartment. Sweet!
Well, Sonia, thank you so much for being here. I'm delighted to have you in the studio and talking about your fantastic operation, Sachère Desserts. Very big fan following.
Thank you very much.
Tell me about how long you've been around and how it came into being and the story of Sachère.
Sure. My career started back in food about in 2003. I started off in cooking and slowly made my way into the restaurant scene, doing that for 2 or 3 years. Then I decided that I really wanted to go back to school and concentrate just on desserts. So back in 2006, I enrolled in ETHQ here in Montreal to do another year and a half of pastry and did that for a little bit. I started to kind of get this idea for myself of where my career was going and what I wanted for the long term. And I started pondering this idea of opening up my own place. Very naive of me going into entrepreneurial work, which I think that it was healthy in a way to start off very naive because the enormity of having your own business can be a little bit overwhelming. I started working at some catering companies in and around Montreal. I kind of stepped away from the restaurant scene after doing that for a little bit. And I started to notice that it was very doable to maybe start my own little catering business. And I also found a niche for high quality desserts in most establishments. You know, creating a whole section for just pastry. Sometimes restaurants is not very realistic. So I said, why not?
So it's been a gradual progression from one part of your career to the next and now into the world of business.
Yes, exactly. I started out slow. I started out from my home back in 2012. And I had my little section there where I started doing these little jars and making jars for restaurants, any type of dessert in a jar. And it took off. It became a little bit hard to manage at times mm-hmm. because working in your home is not ideal. but it took off and I got to the point where 2014, I was in a position where I didn't really know where I should go because it was getting too large for my home. It was getting too much responsibility for just me alone. So I opened Sachet, you know, tax number and all that in 2014.
Little question, where does the name Sachet come from?
So Sachet comes from a very traditional Austrian dessert.
So from the Sacher Torte.
Exactly.
Yes.
So
part of my family tree.
It's something that I've actually, people are quite surprised. I think that I come from Austria or that I have some background, but I really do not. It's just something that in school, in pastry school, it's a very staple cake that we make and that we're taught. And it always kind of left this impression on me about the history and the story behind the Sacher Torte mm-hmm. and how it came to be. And I felt like it was quite inspiring to hear a story about some dessert that was made by a commis that was taken over in the chef's position when he was ill one day and came up with this concoction to serve a royal member that was in Austria, and it became this world success. Everyone knows of it, and you can get it shipped all over the world mm-hmm, now in a mm-hmm. box. And so I thought that it was the core of it was something really traditional and had a lot of meaning and value, and it really struck home with me.
Yeah, there's a lot of different connections in there. But overall, your cakes and pastries and ice creams are very luxurious, very beautiful. Also, there's a simplicity to them, as you said, but yes. they are really delightful and delicious and just extravagant.
Thank you.
Where does that inspiration come from, and what do you draw on for your culinary inspiration?
So I think when I look back at my childhood, I was always really surrounded by cake and ice cream. Any major or big events kind of rotated around fluffy vanilla cake and ice cream beside it. And I think it always really brought me like a lot of comfort and a lot of like great memories. And so when I kind of went into desserts, I really was thinking, okay, well, when I open up my own place, like catering aside, like what do I really want in my shop? And I really wanted to base myself on being a cake shop first and foremost. And so those inspirations really came from some nostalgic part of me, I think. And I think that whenever we look at our food influences or what we're drawn to, a lot of it is connected to our childhood.
Yeah, for sure. And those very often those sweet treats that represent some kind of freedom or glory or liberty or something like this, for me, really speak to us again in adulthood. Do you have favorites that you make or things that recall that fondness of childhood for yourself?
Yeah, well, as you may know, all of my desserts kind of have this Asian influence behind them. And it was really drawn from my childhood as a kid that grew up with two parents that owned their own dojo. Mm. So karate and the Japanese culture was very present when I was 6 or 7 years old. And I did karate myself until I was 14 or 15. So our whole family was really immersed in this culture and got to meet people from Japan, and they taught us the samurai sword, and we would go on tournaments. And that really strikes home for me when talk about childhood memories and influences from other cultures. Yeah. And those things as flavors to me are just really beautiful. And the teas and the citrus flavors like yuzu and the bitterness of matcha and all these things that like I can incorporate into my desserts. Mm. I think those are some of my favorite things.
I'm just starting to think maybe that's why your work resonates so much with my taste buds, because I too was obsessed with Japan as a kid and still am in many ways. Have never been.
Me neither.
Just find something in the flavors, the aesthetics, yeah, the sensibility, the histories, the multiple histories, very compelling. And so maybe
very compelling.
There's just something in the ether about that. I mean, one of the many things I love that Sachette is your cheesecake with the salted caramel topping, which is bitter and salty. The burntness of the caramel complements mm-hmm. the cheesecake. So it's not super sweet. It is very sweet, but it's not like overwhelmingly sweet. And that balance is what I find just like amazing in there. And I would imagine that balances, particularly when you're working with something that is fundamentally sweet, balance is critical.
It is.
So it doesn't become overwhelming when you've got something as luxurious as the cakes you make.
Exactly.
How do you achieve that with all the desserts?
So when you were talking about creating desserts from scratch, which, you know, I can pull recipes from here and there, but ultimately, when we're taught in school about flavor profiles on the tongue, I always try to implement that. So all those components make up a nice balance of flavor. I feel like when I'm trying to compose a dessert or come up with a new dessert, I think it's really important to keep it in mind and try and like when I'm tasting to try and like see, okay, so where is this hitting on my tongue and what do I like about this particular dessert? And I usually try to work with the rule of three. So I try not to bombard the dessert with more than three flavors. And usually one is the main flavor and the other ones should come as a complement. So that's my kind of technique. Mm-hmm. So umami also comes into play with a lot of Japanese flavors, kind of like meaty mm-hmm. Taste. So I would say more when I'm maybe cooking at home for myself, but when we're talking mostly desserts, I try to play on the bitter, the sweet, the sour, and the salty.
Yeah, umami might just be far enough into the unfamiliar for most North American dessert eaters. Something to play with in the future.
Exactly.
But well, thinking about sweet for a while, because this you are in a business that celebrates sweetness mm-hmm. and that recalls the sweetness and the flavors of sweet from our childhood, but also, of course, fat and sweet are what most desserts are made of.
Yes.
But today, in a lot of discourse around diet and what we should be eating, should in big old air quotes, a lot of directives from nutritionists and government organizations and formal bodies that tell us what we should and should not be eating, sugar and fat tend to be demonized.
Yes.
And yet they are obviously also extremely loved. But is there a tension in that for you? I mean, operating a business that basically works in sweet and fat, what's that like?
Yeah, there's definitely this consciousness that you have to keep in mind that not every person can have dessert every day, and we shouldn't. I totally believe in moderation. Moderation is probably a big key of how I like to live my life. And I myself, working as someone that works in it every day, I have to be super aware of this myself. But when it comes to the overall public and owning a business that revolves around such delicate subjects, I feel that we also have to keep in mind that it's not the only thing that is happening in our body. I love hearing people talk about their experiences when they eat, not just like what flavors they're experiencing or tasting or what is maybe overpowering or not, but I also love to hear them say how much they enjoyed it, because You know, sometimes we lose sight of the physical attributes actually happening in our brain when we have sweets. It's this dopamine chemical that's released, and it's something that we actually take, like I was talking to you about before, about our nostalgic, you know, experiences. That's why we want to treat ourselves. It's a feel good. It makes us, we're having a bad day, we want something comforting. Well, we know where to turn. Yeah. But I think that's the balance that we need to find, is that yes, it can, you know, have its side effects health wise, but it can also give us a lot of pleasure.
Yeah. Well, and pleasure is critical in food, and it tends to get ignored a little too often. Food tends to be thought of, not by everybody, but by a lot of people, it's very functional, very necessary, but not about pleasure and not about social connectivity and not about feeling good, whether it's physical or emotional or psychologically. We got to feel good when we eat food, or we will not be healthy, happy people.
Most definitely. And like, it's good to treat ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I kind of tell my clients that I was like, we're not here for your everyday needs. We're here for when you want to treat yourself in the summertime, when you want to bring your children to have ice cream, or when you want to celebrate something, come get a cake. And that's what I try to keep in mind when I'm running my business. It's not always just about calories. It's also about all the other things that are happening to us when we want something sweet.
For sure. It's an equilibrium. It's a balance.
It's a balance.
Back to the balance question. So what's up next for you and for Sasha?
So this is a question that I always have trouble answering, the most part because I feel like what we have just gone through. Mm-hmm. We have just passed 3 years of turmoil and a lot of ups and downs, a lot of uncertainties. I think maybe before COVID, I had maybe a clear vision of where I was wanting to go. And the catering section of Sacher was big and thriving and expanding. The shop was new and people were excited. And it kind of got, I wouldn't say destroyed, because we did a lot during COVID that really we had to change our whole business model around. Mm-hmm. And it did work for us, fortunately. And I thank all of my clients for being so supportive during that time. But it's hard for me now, I think, to see or to plan a future for Sacher. And I think that also has to do a lot with the economy and where we are, like the ripple effects of what we've gone through.
Yeah.
So as far as a creator and a creative person, it's my number one, you know, my creative outlet, but I feel that as long as I can do it, I will do it. I might not have a clear vision on where we're going.
Well, that also sounds like an extremely balanced attitude, if you don't mind me repeating the word, but not knowing,
right,
not planning on giant expansion, taking it as it comes, a little bit of recovery.
Yes.
And then being ready for it to be part of the future or not, depending on where you are.
I think so. And I think that, you know, Sacher truly runs with me and my visions. And like I said, as long as those are thriving and those are there, I will continue and I will serve people and I will try to do my best. But I'm not somebody that's able to look at, you know, opening many locations and being that kind of entrepreneurial go-getter. I feel foremost that I am an artist and I stay true to my craft. And I kind of prioritize that before thinking of, well, where are we going and how am I going to expand?
Yeah. Well, based on what you said, you've already done many things. They keep evolving. So I'll be very excited to see whatever it is that happens next. And thank you so much for spending the time talking with me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
To read more about the origins and more recent history of Sacher Torte, check out the show notes for a link, or just Google it yourself. There are plenty of versions of the story, but which is the truest? I've also linked to Sacher's Instagram account, so you can drool over some of Sonia's gorgeous creations.
Hi, honey. Hi, sugar. Hi, sweetie.
Wow, you're awfully complimentary.
Well, I'm using all the words that you really don't like me calling you.
No, exactly. I was like, what are you doing?
Well, welcome to Stick This in Your Mouth, the sugar edition.
Oh, That yeah. explains it.
Mm-hmm. So we got three sweet tastes to try today.
Well, at least it's not something I dislike.
Yes, no gross food today. Well, you might find one of them gross. I don't know. Depends on your feelings about thick brown sweetness.
Okay.
Molasses.
Ah. Yeah,
so we've got molasses, honey, and maple syrup. Mm. You have a sweet tooth?
Yes, which I try to control.
Why?
I appreciate sweet, but I find that afterwards I get very sleepy and I don't like the feeling.
So sugar is a complicated food substance. You know, we do have all these words to call each other by familiar and fond names that often relate to sugar. But sugar's got a really complicated, messy, and kind of ugly history. The pursuit of sugar, like salt, part of colonialism, part of taking over other people's lands and bodies, enslaving human beings. Sugar and rum and molasses and slavery are all deeply linked in the history of North America and European colonization. Mm-hmm. So much as we like sugar in some of our foods, it's got this really dark history that is often ignored because sugar is such an important economic product as well.
Yes.
So today we're going to try some molasses, molasses being a byproduct of sugar refinement and the base ingredient that is used to ferment and then turn into alcohol and turn into rum specifically. And Montreal itself is an important historical site in the production and processing of sugar and molasses.
Mm-hmm.
The old CBC Radio Canada building is sitting on a site that used to be called Le Faubourg à Molasses, which is where the molasses ships came in and docked. And you could always smell molasses in the air. And molasses is a part of a lot of Quebecois dessert cooking too. So we'll try molasses.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some nice honey from Quebec also, the Miel d'Anisette, a very lovely bee production organization that makes some beautiful honey products, and some Quebecois maple syrup.
Yes.
Each of these three things has complications attached to it, though. So let's taste one. Let's taste the molasses maybe first.
Yes.
Do you like molasses generally?
I do. When I was younger, I think my grandmother made molasses cookies, and I just thought they were like so delicious, especially freshly baked out of the oven.
Yeah.
And my mom used it to cook like ham. Yeah. And so, for a while, maple syrup was quite expensive and molasses was a way to get a hit of sugar without the same cost.
Yeah. It's very dense. It's not quite caramelly, but it's got that boiled down taste, I find.
Yeah.
Does this bring you back to your grandmother's cookies?
Absolutely. Yes. I forget how good molasses
It really is good.
We used to put that on bread. And eat that as dessert.
We used to put it on pancakes.
Mm-hmm.
You have to warm it up, of course, because it's thick when it comes out of the fridge.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm about to pour my most favorite thing that comes from my neck of the woods.
Which is?
La Beauce is a region that is one of the biggest producer of maple syrup. It's like I had an IV when I was a kid.
On a maple syrup drip?
I adore maple syrup.
Why do you love it so much?
Probably because it's a very familiar taste, but it's also, it's not like a refined sugar where all you taste is sweetness. There's variety in the maple syrup. Whether you have it darker or lighter, it will taste different. It goes with almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
I love to add it into my salad dressing, vinaigrettes, and a whole bunch of things. But and just eat it as is, or make a delicious pudding chômage. Or there's so many ways to enjoy maple syrup.
Yeah. So as you were describing that, I was thinking, oh, actually, I think the reason it goes with so many things is that it's got acidity to it, unlike plain white sugar. It actually tastes acidic and sweet.
Yeah.
And a bit bitter.
Yeah.
A bit earthy. Many, many aromatic notes. And so it itself is already very balanced in many ways.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful product.
Well, Quebec produces, 80% of the global supply of maple syrup, somewhere around there. Massive, massive quantities.
Yeah.
It is, of course, also a highly valuable food product. There was a great story about a large quantity of maple being stolen from a maple warehouse. Didn't you tell me
There's actually, I think, a TV series produced by Jamie Lee Curtis, and it's called The Sticky.
Ah, The Sticky. All about the great maple heist of 1812. No, whatever it was, 2017.
Or something.
And of course, maple also, unfortunately, has a kind of dark side to it as well, because the now very important commercial practice of making maple syrup, boiling it down for maple sap, is basically a process that was stolen from the indigenous people here long before the colonizers showed up. So again, it's a very much a kind of colonial extraction process, despite the fact that it is still practiced by First Nations people. It has also been co-opted by much larger industrial and commercial interests. So even as we eat it and love it, it also is a food product with a complicated and somewhat not sweet history.
Absolutely.
All right, move on to honey.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like honey?
I do.
I don't see you actually ever eating honey on toast. It would make it wet, wouldn't it?
That butter thing is following me everywhere.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm talking about my mouthful. I forget how good honey is. It's just not something that I will necessarily go to, but every time I have it, I'm like, oh, this is good.
Well, and honey is, like almost all food products, highly variable. Mm-hmm. Some honeys are very boring and sweet and don't have much depth or complexity to them. This one is an autumn honey, so it's from bees that were pollinating and collecting and producing nectar during the autumn season, so there are different flowers that are around.
Yeah.
The flowers from which the nectar comes have a huge influence on how the honey tastes.
Absolutely, and it's just like, it's a very, it's somewhat herbal and flowery because of it, and a little acidic. It's a very, very complex flavor. It's really interesting. And I'm going to go as much as say it reminds me differently, but I think there's a commonality with miso.
In what way?
There's a sweetness. There's a tiny bit of saltiness. I mean, we're talking about this particular honey.
To me, not surprisingly, maybe, I was thinking about the bee bread that we tried last week, the fermented pollen.
Yes.
Because we weren't eating fermented honey, we were eating fermented pollen, but then the taste between the pollen and this honey in particular is very similar, that fruity. Yep. I'm interested that you said salty. I'm trying to taste that in now.
Just a tiny touch.
So would you put honey on the list of foods that are considered vegan or not?
Ooh, interesting question. Wow.
Because some people say because it's produced through the labor of animals, that is bees, that it's not vegan, that it's exploiting bee bodies to be extracted.
Wow.
And yet it's not.
But at the same time, it is not. It's not like we're eating bees themselves. We're eating what they produce.
But in that way, is it like milk or like eggs, which also are not the animal that we're eating, but we're still eating the animal's products?
Yes. Wow. It's a very complicated issue.
Yeah.
It's a big question.
Yeah.
Which I don't feel equipped to answer.
No, nor do I. It's one of those things like we desperately need pollinators for our food systems to continue to exist. And yet when, like all things, when they get turned into industrial labor forces, the ethical questions start rising.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we will eat many sweet things into the future, my little honey bunny jelly belly.
Au revoir.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Sorry.
When I was young, my mother set some pretty strict ground rules about eating commercial sweets. Homemade cakes and cookies and tarts were generally okay, but chocolate bars in particular were allowable only one day a week. My sister and I could choose which day, and the rule was basically one store-bought treat each. We called these weekly indulgences piggy days, even though to my pre-adolescent mind and body, eating one measly chocolate bar was far from being pig-like. I do recall buying three of them one weekend and hiding them under the upholstered rocking chair in the living room while I played on the floor and periodically snuck mouthfuls while my parents weren't around. In retrospect, though, the idea of qualifying these days as piggy and of hiding my candy consumption even in plain sight is just pretty awful. It put a lot of emotional baggage on pleasure, and to this day I still have a bit of a guilt hangover when I eat any kind of sweet snack. It's unfortunate, of course, because generally speaking, I figured out a pretty good balance in my life when it comes to food. But that sugar shame just still lingers. On the other hand, I also remember the incredible complicitous pleasure of sharing a Snickers bar with my mother, roughly around the same age. We'd put it in the fridge for an hour and then slice it into centimeter-wide segments. Together, she and I would alternate pieces, her eating one, then me, then her. She loved sweet things, whether made by her own clever fingers or purchased at a corner store. And years later, when I was looking for toothpicks in my parents' kitchen drawers, I discovered my mother's semi-secret stash of fancy chocolates and toffee. I laughed, thinking about my own partial efforts to hide my piggy day treats under the rocking chair. The food anthropologist Sidney Mintz has written extensively on sugar, including the remarkable book Sweetness and Power. In it, he describes how sugar was transformed into a day-to-day commodity, having once been a rare and costly luxury affordable to only the very few. The book also shows how dependent the sugar industry has been on the enslavement of human beings and of the exploitation of land in the tropical countries colonized by European powers. Sugar's history is anything but sweet, and I can't help feeling that there's a kind of karmic through line that inhabits the substance. It's comforting and problematic and shameful and lovely and guilt-inducing and celebratory. Oh, sugar. Leaving behind the conflicted territory of honey and molasses and maple and sucrose for a moment, we now come to this week's responses to the food questionnaire. And despite how much I admire all of the respondents to date, this is a particularly special one for me. I find it very sweet, because in addition to being a tireless champion of workers' rights, a leader in labor organizing and union politics, and a keen defender of democracy and justice, our food questionee is also my big sister. Elizabeth Santo is a union organizer working in healthcare and higher education, trying to make sure that the people who do the work have a voice in the decisions that affect them. She has volunteered and worked in labor for nearly 40 years, improving the lives and livelihoods of thousands and thousands of people. I could not be more proud to call her my sister. When Elizabeth and I recorded her answers to the questionnaire, she described herself as being in a transitional stage in her life, sad about the world, and hopeful about collective change. Elizabeth, what is your idea of a perfect food?
Oh, something that's easy to produce or produced by someone else, but ideally shared with friends.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
Gristle. I really hate gristle.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
I think the kind of urgency that I feel about getting on with other things so that I'm not thinking too much about it. I think a lot of people have various versions of that. And of course, profit.
Which food person do you most admire?
Oh, you. For thinking about food.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Kombucha. No interest.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
There was a lovely little Spanish restaurant I used to go to with my then boyfriend that served filet mignon with a scoop of garlic butter. Fortunately, it's closed, so I might live another decade or so.
For what do you hunger?
Justice and peace, of course, sleep and cookies.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
If there's not enough to go around, or, of course, if I don't like it.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
They are almost all too high. I'm 5'2", and I've been peering over the top of dinner tables since I was a kid.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
Not too sweet, not too tart, but juicy.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Oh, butter. I know that's not a condiment, but that's the real answer.
What kind of gardens make you happiest?
Where there's food for the picking. Cherry tomatoes fresh off the vine, or blackberries, or snap peas, or figs. There's something luxurious about just picking and eating food.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
That it would be easier to eat healthily on the go.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
Getting my son and husband to cook.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
My electric kettle.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Mac and cheese.
What is your favorite aroma?
Garlic, baking bread, bacon, coffee. They all hold promise.
What do you most value in your friend's food?
The company.
What is your most powerful sense?
Touch.
What would you eat as your second to last meal?
A fresh batch of my son's beef stew, so that I could have leftovers as my last meal.
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
Elizabeth, 16, did not cook.
What question would you either add to this questionnaire or like to ask me?
What smallish change can the average person make that would contribute to making food systems more balanced?
And that's it for this sweet and sour episode of Making a Meal of It. Many thanks to the generous Jordan LaBelle, the stupendous Sonia Samut, the energizing Elizabeth Santo, and of course my main man, the maximal Maxime Giroux. Intense gratitude, respect, and apologies to the myriad pollinators whose work keeps humans alive, and to the many vegetative life forms whose saps and nectars are the source of so much comfort. The show notes this week include links to some of the foods and stories we talked about in the various segments, and if you have any recipes for delicious things, please share them via social media. You can find the Making a Meal of It podcast on many of the social platforms. Next week, we turn to another complex food theme, that of meat and power. Like sugar, there are no simple stories when it comes to the flesh and flavor of animals. We'll hear from a political scientist whose research focuses on meat and its many ecologies, as well as an artisan butcher whose careful attention to meat and charcuterie embodies the idea of value. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, Selamat makan and AI kako.